This morning, as promised, I'm going to talk about a line. How's this sound? Can you hear?
Yeah.
A line in the song of the Jewelmere Samadhi. And the line goes, when the wooden man begins to sing, the stone woman gets up dancing. And scholars tell us that this line references a passage in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. And I will talk about that reference as we go on. But I think first it's, when we meet a line like this, a line in a Zen poem, a Zen text, it's good just to take it at face value. Just, how does it strike us? And the first thing that, comes to mind for me is there's an inanimate object that's becoming animate, that's coming to life. So that's a nice poetic image and in itself. And since this is a Zen text, we probably want to ask, well, what does this have to do with our practice? What does this have to do with our teaching and our realization of that teaching? So, there's something rigid, right? A wooden man, stone woman, something solid and not moving, coming to life. And so we might think, well, what is it? What is it that is rigid in me that needs to come to life? What fixed views or concepts am I holding on to that keeps me stuck or mired down in some fixed orientation? And what is the power? What is the power? What is the underlying power that brings this wooden man or this stone woman to life? What power animates, we could say, what power animates the true self? What power brings us into close contact with the basis or the truth of our lives? It brings us into contact. What kind of power brings us into contact with the truth, the real basis of our lives? So we have a Thursday morning study group, and recently someone in the study group brought up the theory of evolutionary biology. And not surprisingly, according to this theory, what motivates and Yeah, what motivates sentient beings is the desire to preserve their species, and the way that that operates is on the basis of self-interest. What's in it for me? How can I best promulgate my species, and never mind about, you know, those other species, just, you know, what do I need to evolve and develop and preserve my particular incarnation or body. And you know, this is how, you know, a lot of smart people think this is the way, this is how we came, you know, from a single cell to well, or even before that, but let's just start with a single cell, how we came from a single cell into these complex life forms that we know today on planet Earth. By all of these life forms struggling to preserve themselves and promulgate themselves and evolve themselves based on the idea of me in, as you know, this being as the most important being there is to get ahead. So, you know, that has led to a wonderful array of life on this planet, but it has also led to things like war, and it also has led to things like the extinction of myriad species. So this there's a little bit of a flaw in this theory, or at least maybe we won't say there's a flaw, but let's just say that it has, you know, it has negative consequences for certain aspects of life, you know, some manifestations of life. So all beings acting in their own self-interest. And in the alternative to that, we have, when we come into this hall, this zendo, this place of Dharma expression, we are presented with an alternative view. And the alternative view in our Mahayana tradition is the view of the Bodhisattva. And the Bodhisattva who has a vow to benefit others before him or herself, or to benefit others along with him or herself. And that's an alternative vision that has been, you know, the people who came up with that vision didn't know about the theory of evolutionary biology, but anyway, they probably certainly saw a kind of conflict and negative aspects of all beings acting solely in their own self-interest. And so, as a spiritual vision, they came up with this alternative. The Bodhisattva who vows to save more than him or herself. So when I started to Zen practice, it was there was a phrase, there was a phrase going around called the counterculture. Some of you probably remember that word. You hardly ever hear that word anymore. But back in the, you know, 60s, early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, there was quite a bit of talk about the counterculture. And, you know, so this was another, this was an alternative vision to actually to war, which was the Vietnam War at that time. And it was people trying to present an alternative vision to the negative consequences of naked self-interest or naked perceived self-interest. Since we later found out that it wasn't in our self-interest at all to prosecute the Vietnam War. Not at all. It hurt our society greatly, and it hurt, obviously, the Vietnamese unbelievably. But some powerful people thought it was in their self-interest to prosecute that war. So, in any case, the counterculture arose at that time. And the counterculture didn't want to go along with that vision. And I was one of those people, and I did not want to go along with that vision. And some people were suggesting an alternative vision. And the alternative vision was, let's cooperate and let's base our society on love and caring for others. And that was a movement. That wasn't just some religious, you know, sect, you know, carrying on. This was a society, you know, a movement that permeated throughout the society, in every state, in every city, in every hamlet. That vision of that alternative vision was being tried out, and it was a different kind of animating power, a different way of being, a different way of conducting oneself and thinking about oneself, one's life. And this animating power in some circles was called flower power. You remember flower power? And Eiken Roshi wrote a book at that time on the precepts. And he called it the mind of clover. So he was talking about flower power. He was talking about the mind that arises in Zazen, that animates us in Zazen, that's based on ethical conduct, right conduct. And so we're reading in the study group, we're reading the book called Becoming Yourself. And I would propose that when Suzuki Roshi used that term a lot, and Juryu, who made that book, this new book of Suzuki Roshi's lectures, called it Becoming Yourself, because Suzuki Roshi used that word, that phrase, quite a bit. And so I would propose that falling under the sway of this alternative vision of cooperation and love, that kind of animating power to our lives, that is what Suzuki Roshi is talking about. That's, at least, I don't want to put words in his mouth. I would just say, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about falling under the sway of that animating power of cooperation and love is what animates our lives. There's a subsequent line to the line that I'm talking about this wooden man and stone woman. The subsequent line to that is, ministers serve their lords, children obey their parents. Not obeying is not filial, and not serving is no help. So this obeying and serving is done by people who fall under the sway of this power, this animating power, this alternative vision of power. And this power follows for us in this sect, in this Buddhist world, follows the imperative of the Dharma. We act in response to the Dharma. The Dharma has an imperative, and it's calling us, it's always calling us toward cooperation and caring and love. And we act, and when we do this practice, this wonderful practice brings forth in us this alternative animating power. And I would suggest that's why the stone woman and the wooden man begin to get up dancing, because they represent bodhisattvas who have fallen under the sway of this practice and are acting from that place. So, as I'm involved, and you know, on Sunday afternoons, I'm involved in a long-term study of the Avatamsaka Sutra, the Flower Garland Sutra. And one of the things that I've come to appreciate in reading that sutra is how, this is a 1600 page sutra. I don't know if it's the longest sutra. I think it must be, but anyway, in the Buddhist world. But I've come to appreciate how much the sutra focuses on practice and morality of the bodhisattva. It's a big theme. I mean, it's not the only theme. The other big theme is on the activities of Buddhas, particularly Vairochana Buddha. But there's a great deal of ink spilled, as they say, on the bodhisattva and the bodhisattva's way of life. And the sutra is constantly extolling, explicating and extolling and parsing in various ways the bodhisattva's way of being, way of conducting himself, herself. Big theme in that sutra. And so it's made me sensitive to thinking about whenever I read Zen text or Mahayana sutra, I should keep in my mind, does that sutra have something to say about the life of a bodhisattva? Is that what it's talking about? So I think this is a good, when you're studying Zen texts and so forth, it's a good thing to keep in mind. Is this saying something about, for instance, in this line, is this wooden man and this stone woman, is this saying something about the life of a bodhisattva? And yes, indeed, that line is saying something about the life of a bodhisattva. And also the joy. There's an aspect of joy in that too. There's something joyful about singing and dancing, is there not? And so it seems like whatever these bodhisattvas are up to, if these are representing bodhisattvas, they're actually having a good time. This is bringing them joy to do this practice, and when they feel joy, they can express joy, so they become expressive and start handing out their joy, handing out, you know, the flowers. Do you remember? No, some old people here remember. You know, there's a famous picture of some hippie person handing a flower to someone like in the National Guard, right? And many of us in that era, you know, had interactions with police and National Guard and so forth. Because like today, the state was not happy about protest. The powers that be were not happy about an alternative vision that was being brought forth. It wasn't, in truth, always being brought forth gently. We have to acknowledge that. But in any case, I stray away. I'm... according, now I'm come around to this referent that I mentioned in the Prajnaparamita Sutra, to this, where this line has some correspondence with. It's found in the Perfection and Wisdom in 8,000 lines, and this is a very important sutra for us because it's the only one, as far as I know, at least as far as I knew, when I was studying these things more intensively, it's the only one that's been translated into English. There's a Perfection of Wisdom in 25,000 lines, in 50,000 lines, in 100,000 lines, but this 8,000-line Prajnaparamita is the only one that's been translated into English. And you can get a copy of it. So the scholars point to this passage in the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 lines as the referent to this wooden man, stone woman analogy. An expert carver might make of wood an automatic man or woman, a puppet that could be moved by pulling the strings. Whatever action it was made to perform, that action it would perform. And yet that wooden man would have no discriminations. Because it is so constituted, it lacks all discriminations. Just so, a bodhisattva performs the work for the sake of which he develops the perfection of wisdom, but the perfection of wisdom remains without discrimination. Because that perfection of wisdom is so constituted that it lacks all discriminations. So here, indeed, we find that the referent is to the activity of a bodhisattva, and one of the hallmarks of bodhisattva activities is that it is without discrimination. It is not clinging to good or bad or right or wrong. It recognizes, the bodhisattva recognizes there are preferences, and there is activity that is wholesome and there is activity that is unwholesome. But the bodhisattva does not cling, does not grab onto, does not grip these opposites. They can be observed, but the bodhisattva is the bodhisattva's practice. I mentioned this the other night in the full moon ceremony. The bodhisattva's practice is the mind of equality. So the mind of equality, from the mind of the equality, you can see that there is good and bad, right and wrong. But you don't say good is much better over here and bad is very much worse and over there. Not so there's this underlying the bodhisattva doesn't take a stand anywhere. If you're to have you heard that? That's a frequent reference in the Prajnaparamita Sutra. The bodhisattva, where does the bodhisattva take a stand? There is nowhere standing. I'm not quoting it right, but there's no place that a bodhisattva stands and says and holds up a flag and says, I plant my flag here and now I own Greenland. No, bodhisattvas don't do that. So there are many virtues of the bodhisattva. And it does seem, I want my notes bring me back to saying that it does seem, when we talk about an automatic man or woman, to be an odd analogy for a bodhisattva, like someone who has no will or mind of his or her own, but is simply pulled by the strings of who knows who, right? But this is I understand this as this is the bodhisattva responding to the imperative. The strings are like the imperative of the Dharma, and acting in accord with and being completely responsive to the imperative of the Dharma, without stint, without holding back. So that's how I understand it. I understand it as the bodhisattva is willing to be pulled this way and that way in accord with the Dharma. He's having the experience that he's having, and he notices the experience, or she notices the experience she's having, but she doesn't, she's mindful of that experience. That's another practice of bodhisattvas, is they stay mindful of the experience that they are having, without necessarily getting completely pulled into negative experience, not getting mired down, overwhelmed in negative experience, and not getting, you know, overly exuberant and out of control over, you know, positive, wonderful experience, and also not thinking, this experience will always continue. It will always be like this. You know, this is sentient beings have that habit, right? Oh, this is terrible, and it'll always be terrible. Or this is good, and it'll always be good. You know, so bodhisattvas have a little bit of more perspective, you could say, on that kind of experience. So I really think an important part of this puppet on a string analogy is for us is to key in on the fact that the puppet, whatever action, it says, the line in the passage in the Prajnaparamita says, whatever action, would be indicated by the string, the puppet would perform. You know, whatever action it was indicated, it would perform. In other words, the bodhisattva is responsive. And we have aspects within our zendo activity that work to help us to be responsive. So we have densho bell out there, and when we hit the densho bell, it means stop what you're doing. You know, finish your cup of tea. It's okay to finish your cup of tea, but stop what you're doing and go to the zendo. We hit the densho bell. So when we hear that instruction, we're training ourselves in responsiveness. The densho bell is struck. Okay, now I should stop my walk, or I should stop my cup of tea and clean up, you know, what I need to do or whatever to be responsible. But my movement now is going to be toward the zendo, because that's what the densho bell means. And similarly, you know, zazen itself has lots of responsive genes built into it. I don't know, that's a funny word, but you know, when we sit down in this posture, if we sit down in this posture and we take this upright posture and we put our hands just so, and we open up through the chest and we relax the shoulders, and we keep our head balanced on top of our shoulders and sit upright, and we do this day in and day out, and week in and week out, and year in and year out, and we do this decade in and decade out, this creates a responsiveness in us to this posture. This posture, you sit down in this posture and it changes your mind. And why does it do that? Because you've done it. You've built in yourself a response to this posture. This body mind responds to this posture. It responds to this, to the breath in this posture. It responds to the posture itself. The body mind. And sometimes this is really noticeable, right? Sometimes it's not so noticeable. But sometimes, maybe say you haven't been sitting in a while, and you sit down, and you take this posture, and all of a sudden you just are flooded with some resonance. There's something resonating, like it's a, like a bell itself that has been struck in you. And your body and mind just responds to this posture. And this is a responsiveness that is cultivated by our repeated engagement in zazen. I heard a talk. Yeah, I heard a talk by Reverend Mio, and he said something quite on point on this topic. He said, "What is helpful is to let the Dharma operate unhindered in you." What is helpful is to let the Dharma operate unhindered in you. So in the wooden man, you know, and stone woman, they're representing these bodhisattvas that are letting the Dharma operate unhindered in them. And when that Dharma is operating unhindered in them, joy arises, more enthusiasm for the practice arises, and we create a virtuous cycle of call and response. The Dharma is calling and we're responding, and that virtuous cycle, that's letting the Dharma operate unhindered in you. You know, letting go of past and future in zazen, and letting the Dharma operate unhindered in you. So I've gone over time somehow, which always happens. I'm about to come to an end, but I want to. I wouldn't be really complete for this talk if I didn't talk about the whole couplet of the wooden man, because the wooden man begins to sing. When the wooden man begins to sing, the stone woman gets up dancing. It's not within the reach of feeling or discrimination. How could it admit of consideration in thought? That's the completion of the couplet. It's not within the reach of feeling or discrimination. How could it admit of consideration in thought? So I have a question for the assembly. What do feeling, discrimination, and thought have in common? Body.
No, they come and go.
Come and go. That's true. They come and go.
So.
Well, I'm going to answer for the assembly.
Please.
Which is, you know, a thing that is done. You read about it anyway. They are each one of them. One of the what we call the skandhas, or the upadana skandhas. So the skandhas, as you know, are form, feeling. There's the feeling, perception, which is also discrimination. You know, perception and discrimination are synonyms in Buddhist lingo. Feelings, perceptions, formations. Karmic formations, and consciousness, which thought. So feeling, discrimination, and thought are each one of the... They're standing in for all the five skandhas. And, they are also called the upadana skandhas, which means the five skandhas that are grasped, that grasping sanghas, skandhas. These are the five skandhas that are grasped, or that grasp us, that grasp us. And so when you're a stone woman and you want to get up dancing, it being in the grip of the skandhas is like having mud on your shoes. You can't dance freely when you're in the grip of the Upadana skandhas. So our practice is what is, according to the Heart Sutra, relative to the skandhas. Seeing them as, seeing the skandhas as, gracias. empty, not clinging, nothing to cling to, nothing to be clung to. So when the stone man begins to, the wooden man begins to sing and the stone woman gets up dancing, it's not within the reach of feeling or discrimination. Isn't it? This is a very exuberant line. This is a very exuberant line. These people are just, they're in danger of being completely liberated. You know, they're really on the edge there. This wooden man and stone woman. So, somewhere along the line, thinking about this talk, I thought the good ending was, for this talk was, respondez, s'il vous plaît. Respondez, s'il vous plaît. Let yourself be a responder. Be like the stone woman, the wooden man, responsive to the imperative of the Dharma and all that that means.